Today's talk, I'm going to be talking about the high field ground state of graphene, and if time permits, then I'll show some thermal power results also in high fields. Where's the pointer? So this is all the work of Joe Chakalsky. It is his thesis. There was some help from Lou, but he has graduated, so Joe is all alone now. All right, so well, graphene has been introduced, so I can go through this very quickly. So we know that there are two valleys, K and K prime, and these equations are lifted from Ando's excellent review in a few years ago. All right, so in a magnetic field, the momentum, you minimal couple it, and you can write this as a raising and lowering operator. So the reason for showing this is to remind you that when you write down the eigenstates in the simplest non-interacting case, there's something funny about n equals zero. So you can work this out very easily yourself. This is square root n that everyone knows. But when you set n equal to zero, then you have no electrons in one of the so the spinner refers to A site and B site occupation. So there are no electrons in this case in the A site. So the K and K prime valley index becomes identical to A and B sublattice index, only for the n equals zero. So to me, this took me a long time for me and my students to understand, because if you write down all the indices, there are really eight, right? There are the eight indices to take care of. At n equals zero, it simplifies, and yet it brings in this very interesting possibility that if you just consider one valley, the electrons at the zero Landau level will sit at one sublattice. But then, of course, it's not really a charge density wave, because the other valley, K prime, fills in the other sites. So when you turn on interaction, it's going to be sensitive to this selective occupation of sublattice. And many of you, so I make sure that everyone that I've talked to is listed here. I might be missing some names. These names are still, I think they're all friends of mine. They remain friends of mine. And I got lots of helpful advice, but it's always the same advice. The advice is, you need not read further. Here it is. Just refer to my paper. So I read all these papers many times and got thoroughly confused. So many people have considered role of interaction in graphene, and n equals zero is a good place to test these ideas. So one class of theories, this is the one that really got me interested, because Patrick at a conference in Taiwan took me aside and told me all about his ideas. So the n equals zero level is fourfold degenerate, right? Two valleys, two spins. Two valleys means two sublattices, from what I said. So the assumption is the ferromagnetic exchange for the physical spin, not the pseudo spin, for the physical spin is triggered by exchange and splits spin up from spin down, but the valley degeneracy remains unlifted. But when you go towards the edge, because of the zigzag or armchair geometry, the edge distinguishes between A and B. Right? And so the valleys are split in opposite directions at the edge. Then if you tune your chemical potential to the Dirac point, these two states always cross, so it's protected. And on that basis, they predicted the existence of counter-propagating edge modes. Right? Spin up goes one way, spin down goes the other way. And many, many groups, actually, Ferdic, Bernadette, Zhang, and so on, had the same idea. So we immediately switched our research direction and started to make graphene. And Phil Kim, I must thank him, actually, gave us a Kish graphite, generously gave us a lot of Kish graphite. Thank you. There's another place where I'm going to thank Phil again, in the thermal power. So we started to make samples, and with hints from Phil and so on, and we started to carry out these experiments. Now, at the same time, the graphene problem has very deep roots, as all of you know. Let me just remind you. So Applequist and so on use a two-dimensional Dirac physics, and you know this now goes by the name of QED3. It's 2 plus 1. So if you have a chiral symmetry breaking term, that's a mass term. Right? You convert a neutrino to an electron, so this is called a pseudoscalar. Now, then Mirensky et al. Realized that in solid-state context, a magnetic field does that. So this goes by the name that they invented, magnetic catalysis. I think it sort of had a bad name to it in the context of graphite, where it was invoked to be by, for example, Vashenko and so on, for explaining certain anomalies in graphite. That's still an experimentally open question. But in graphene, this is a real possibility. So in condensed matter context, the magnetic field enhances the density of states at a direct point, leads to excitonic condensation of electron-hole pairs. The order parameter, see, it's a difference between A-site and B-site sublattice occupation. So here's where the confusion comes in. So Alan MacDonald, who's not here, but you know, I think I'm not misquoting him, told me that, well, this is really the same thing as the pseudo-spin now, the same exchange that I talked about a bit before. Instead of lifting the physical spin degeneracy, first pops open the valley degeneracy. Right? Instead of having the upspin and downspin being split, this would be a real ferromagnetic state. It's the pseudo-spin, they get split first, then you don't get this. So you would get a charge density wave, and maybe that's it, right? But anyway, so I think Mirensky may agree or not agree with him. It's not clear. I'm not a theorist. There's a big fight going on about whether this is simply valley splitting by the same exchange mechanism. So we did our experiments, and immediately we found on pure samples, on high, low disorder samples, I should say. So this particular sample has a mobility of 50,000. You see this very strange effect. Let me put it this way. So we hold the temperature at 300 millikel, and as you increase the field, the N equals minus 1 and plus 1 Landau levels move apart, right? So this is all consistent with Geim's data and Phil's data. But the N equals 0 state shoots up. So even at 8 Tesla, it's already 3 times higher than the N equals 1. And these don't change very much. If you go to 14 Tesla, this shoots up to about 200 kiloohms per square. So please remember that number, right? 0.2 megaohms at 14 Tesla at our lowest base temperature, 300 millikel. The Hall steps don't show anything different than what is known in the literature, except this diverging RXX at the Dirac point forces you to have a zero Hall step. But that's just a consequence of matrix inversion. Right? If RXX is going to infinity, you must have zero Hall conductivity. So we were very puzzled and tried very hard to understand that. So this is showing the data now compressed, and you see it reaches to about 200 kiloohms, right? Either holding the field fixed or and decreasing temperature, or the other way around, holding the temperature at the base temperature and increasing magnetic field. Then we found that actually this is sample dependent. And if you take a whole slew of samples, Kish 7, 5, so on and so forth, depending on their offset gate voltage. So offset gate voltage means how much gate voltage you need to put to pull the chemical potential to the Dirac point. Because when you lay it down, you're bound to pick up a lot of charge impurities. Yes, yeah, by the divergent maximum. And here. Right. So when I set it at zero, I've artificially shifted the origin, right? But here I haven't shifted it. So the larger the offset gate voltage, 25 volts, you see the smaller the divergence. But when in this particular sample, K7, the offset is 1 volt, and that's very good. And you can see that it really has this divergence. The zero Hall step, you know, like I said, it's a mere consequence of the vanishing of all XX. Look at the sigma XX. Now you see the split, the lifting of the first degeneracy. We don't know what it is. Is it the ferromagnet or is it the valley valley magnet, the valley polarization. But even at 100 Kelvin, you already see the two states resolved. It's always asymmetric for reasons that bedevil all experimentalists. Okay, so this is the first sample. The surprise is that when you cool it down, this divergence actually eventually saturates. Here I'm showing it as a conductance, simply the reciprocal, since the Hall conductance is zero, and you know you have a tenfold decrease, and then it saturates below 2 Kelvin, and so on and so forth. So this was some concern to us. Here I'm showing another way to look at the divergence, and this is actually going to be the standard way I'll plot it. Now I call the Dirac point Rxx R sub zero, just for notational simplicity. And if you set your chemical potential at the Dirac point, run the field up, at high temperatures it doesn't do anything interesting. But as you go colder and colder, this divergence starts to grow, right? And as I said, the maximum value is about 200 kilo-ohms, and actually we have enough field to actually track it higher, right? So especially in this sample, K22, which is even closer to the offset gate voltage is even smaller. I think this one is 0.5 volts. And you can see that the divergence occurs even earlier. And K18 has a larger offset, so it's postponed to a higher field. But they all do it. Every sample that we have examined, depending on how low in temperature you go and how high a field you go, eventually starts to shoot up. Yeah. At 0 Kelvin? Yeah, that's a theoretical concept. See, we're always at, we can follow the trend. So yeah, let's return to that when I show the new data. Yeah. So we try to send it to Nature Physics. We weren't that ambitious, so we have to have a color plot, right? A contour plot. And this took a ridiculous amount of time. And it serves no purpose except to show that, so here's the interesting part. If you hold the field, temperatures now is logarithmic. If you hold the field at low values, like 10 Tesla, you know, it starts to increase in resistance, R0. But then below a certain temperature, 3 Kelvin, the contour is horizontal, right? So it is saturated. But if you go to a higher field, this saturation doesn't happen till you get to, say, 1 Kelvin, but eventually it does as well. So then the question immediately arises, well, go to the magnet lab and cool it down. What happens when you go to higher temperature, higher fields, and what happens if you scan at zero temperature? So at our base temperature, 300 millikelvin, you can see that it's increasing very rapidly. Right, there's no saturation versus field. It's going from something like 10 kilo ohms, the quantum of resistance, to about 200 kilo ohms. That's the number that I wanted you to remember. No, nothing of that physics. No, this is all. We are in the quantum Hall regime. It's just that I haven't focused on the n equals plus 1 or minus 1. Everything is with regard to n equals zero. So in that context, you know, you are suddenly splitting the fourfold degeneracy, right? Lifting one of the degeneracies, and I'm looking at the valley in between. Right. Then we got worried. So we look at the literature. This is Phil's, one of his early papers. Early means 2 years ago. This is a famous plot from Abedin et al. In collaboration with Gein, but this is only 4 Kelvin. And you know, if you look at it, it looks like it's trying to get up there, but probably the offset is so high that you never get enough field, even at 30 Tesla. Unfortunately, they did not record the offset voltage of this sample. Here's the sample that we call K7, and it's taking off rather steeply. And I don't know how good your eye is in estimating divergences. This is not a power law. It's steeper than the power law. Mm-hmm. Sorry? No. 4 Kelvin, it's doing this. It's doing this. No. So to get this behavior, we need to go to 40 Kelvin. Yeah, it all depends on your offset voltage. I showed the data earlier. Here you go. Right? That's the same sample. So I just showed you 0.3. So you need to go to 40 Kelvin to match that Abedin data. Right? Yes. Yeah. So we have been very careful about doing that. You notice that in case 7, the solid line is data taken in continuous trace. And the broken the circles are taken by sweeping gate voltage and looking at the maximum. And they both agree. You know, so you have to be careful about that you're not falling off the cliff or whatever, right? So this was very puzzling. Why it was doing this in conflict with previous work. Then we realized that because of this sample dependency, we better be careful about checking the other parameters. And this has been shown earlier this morning, right? So Phil Kim's group has done the systematic check as well. But here we are plotting it as RXX. But if we were to plot this as sigma or G, then it would just be Vs, right? So this would be a very steep V, and this would be very broad. I hope you can see this yellow curve here. Anyway, the message is the larger the offset voltage, the broader and therefore the lower the mobility. This corresponds to 50,000 in mobility. That corresponds to maybe 8,000. So it systematically broadens out. And you will see later on that the divergence, the critical field, also correlates. You know, this has probably, let's see, this is about 10 or 12 Tesla critical field. That would correspond to about 35 Tesla. So this order is playing a role. This is the message that came from Shankar's talk. And so we are sort of trying to look at what the pure system would do, but through a smoky glass, right? So we're sort of looking at the trend, and I think the trend is real. We're looking at intrinsic behavior because we know what disorder does to the trend that I'm trying to report here. Question? Yeah. I'll come back to that. Yeah. Right, because remember I showed you that if you're below the critical field, it goes up and it saturates, right? But what happens above? Now, why do we stop at 200 kilo ohms? And this is very hard to explain to the referees. You see, most experiments prior to this work, then this is what you would do, right? You would hold the current at 1 nanoamp, and then you would sweep gate voltage, because you want to see all these oscillations. But if you did that unknowingly, you heat up the sample enormously, because you're really talking about a single atomic layer. A nanoamp is a lot of current. And so 10 picowatts is about the threshold that it will tolerate at 1 Kelvin. And this will trigger a thermal runaway. So these are samples of what we encounter. Look at this sample here. Even though we're plotting it to 10 mega ohms, this is obviously garbage, right? This is basically the sample trying its best to find a low resistance path, and it oscillates, and it's boiling off helium-3 all the time. So even though you get the 10 mega ohms, we don't trust this at all. So we at this stage did not report anything above 200 kilo ohms. Here's another one that's even more serious. So as soon as, you know, you keep it at 10 nanoamps, as soon as the resistance goes to 400 kilo ohms, the power dissipation exceeds 10 picowatts and it goes crazy. It just go crashing down and do something really strange. These are to very high fields. And worse still, if you naively just hold the sample at fixed field and sweep the gate, you see that you run into thermal runaway right here without knowing it, because you're holding your current fixed, right? And this could fool you. You think you're looking at fractional quantum Hall effect. It's simply the sample doing this when you make the other cut. So this was a major experimental obstacle, and it was very hard to convince the community that we knew what we were doing. And so we basically backed off and looked devised a different technique altogether. So put very simply, instead of holding the current fixed, you attempt to hold the voltage fixed, and then monitor both the current and the voltage to get your true conductance. But by holding the voltage fixed, which we do at 40 microvolts, that's the total voltage drop across here, and phase detect current instead of voltage, you can get equally good measurements. But this time your power dissipation drops dramatically, right? So the higher the resistance, the better the power dissipation, the lower. Now it's down to 10 attowatts. And this we feel is now completely adequate for the job. So in addition, we have banks of low-pass filters, PI filters, to make sure there's no room temperature radiation coming in. We have choke resistors in the bath. And anyway, so that's and this is what we see. And now 200 kilo-ohms, let me look at the main panel. 200 kilo-ohms cannot be resolved from the green line. And in this particular sample, the offset wasn't as good as the first one. So you need about 25 Tesla to trigger this. But watch the sucker. I mean, this goes up. It just goes up vertically. And this is 20 mega ohms. And actually, we can follow it to 40 mega ohms, which will be here. And 40 mega ohms for the theorist here, you know, you're starting to impinge on the input impedance of your lock-ins. And so you don't trust anything beyond that, right? So, No. Not in my experience. Yeah. I have chased after phase transitions for decades. This is the first one where a field triggers a quantum of resistance to a true insulator. We believe this is a true insulator, as you see. Yeah. Take 40 mega ohms as what we can reasonably accomplish. We have data above 40, but the phase of the lock-in starts to complain, right? Because it has 100 mega ohm input impedance. You're asking it to track a 40 mega ohm sample. It's going to get very confused. So we don't trust anything above 40 mega ohms. You warm up the sample. All right, so here's what I want you to note. Please, if you are above the critical field, which for this sample is about 27 Tesla, it's very temperature dependent. This is activated. I'll show you data later. So at 27 Kelvin, right, you're not seeing anything very high. But if you are below what I call the critical field, you see that, you know, as you raise temperature, decrease temperature, it goes up, but then it saturates right here. And that's because it's hitting this curve, which as you'll see, we fit to the Kostelitz-Stawless correlation length. But I'll revisit this point later. So I want to expand this region and show it as an inset. And you can see that 27 Kelvin, it gets up to 200 kilo-ohms. That was the number I wanted you to remember. But then if you get below 5 Kelvin, you see, it's starting to saturate, right? You can barely resolve it. But when you go to higher fields, you do resolve it. But between 1.5 and 0.3 Kelvin, it's basically saturated. There's something very interesting going on here. We don't think it's due to heating. I'll return to this later. So this is singular. It will not fit any power law, except with a very, very large exponent. So the thing that occurred to us was, well, it's obviously exponential, and so that reminded us of the Kostelitz-Stawless correlation. And it fits like a charm. I can defend this theoretically because, well, I'll come to the reasons later. Anyway, so this you recognize as the square of the Poslitz-Stahlitz correlation length, where instead of the temperature T, the field is inducing the transition at low temperature. So I replace that with H. H is the reduced field. And B should be of the order of 1, right, for the theory to make sense. And over 3 decades, right, so the obvious thing would be to plot log of R versus this quantity, which is here. But the unknown is HC. So there's only one adjustable parameter. If you get the upper critical field wrong, it swings one way. If you get it too high, it swings the other way. But so we are relying on the straight fit to determine the upper critical field. Sorry, I keep saying upper critical field because I used to work in cuprates. It's the critical field. Critical field. So if I slip into that bad habit, just think of it as critical field. And, you know, this is 3 decades. I mean, this is telling us something. Maybe we're wrong about KT transition, but certainly the fit is That's a good question. Yes, it could be different from 1/2. Yeah. We haven't done that. That's a good point. Yeah. What else did I want to say? So you can see some of these stray points out here. That's the lock-in going out of phase, right? Because this is now above 40 megaohms. The data actually bounces up and down like that. So we ignore anything above 40 megaohms. Yeah. That is certainly something that's a way out for this problem. Why is it a classical 2D transition when it should be a 2 plus 1? Because this is putatively a quantum transition. We're not making that claim, but I'm just presenting it the way that we fit the data. Good question. At 1K, the fit HC comes down. Goes up. So you need we did the fit by varying, we have explored the fit by varying the doping. I'll come back to that later. 3 samples do the same thing. Some have, you know, all these noise that comes from, again, you know, the lock-in complaining. You notice that the slope is the same. So B is the same because it's not adjustable, right? It's whatever the straight line slope gives you. So we think we're looking at the same phenomenon. The critical field is always is different, as I've indicated here. That's the sample I showed you. This one has 36, this one's 32. So again, it's sample dependent, but the slope is all the same. So here I'm presenting all the samples that we have confidence in, 5 samples. The K7 is the one that I talked about first, goes to 200 kiloohms. This one's even better, takes off earlier. And these 3 are the ones that I just showed you. So one complaint was that, why didn't you do this to K7 and follow this up? Well, we didn't have the technique. And these samples do not survive a warm-up to room temperature, as Phil will tell you. You always lose a couple of leads, and that's it. So it's easier to just make another sample. So the hope now for the next few months is to look for samples that have very low offset gate voltage so that HC is very low, and we can do the full study within the lab rather than having to go to the magnet lab, which is quite an expensive proposition. So temperature dependence. In one of the samples, we can follow the temperature down to about 2 Kelvin, and you can hold the field fixed, right? So the transition for this sample is about 32 Tesla. I didn't write it anywhere. So this is very close to near the transition. When you are close to the transition, you see that it follows a purely activated form, the broken line, the dashed line. But then it starts peeling away if you're not quite beyond the transition field. But if you now step back, right, away from the transition, it peels off earlier. And so these other curves are sort of heading for saturation. So that may answer your question, Mansour. So when you are above HC, this goes to infinity. But of course, we cannot chase it. But notice this is log scale, right? So it's increasing by several orders of magnitude as you cool down from 16 Kelvin. These are expensive experiments because you have to persuade the magnet lab to hold the field at 30 Tesla while you're slowly cooling down, right? And you know, at $50,000 a pop, it's expensive.
Right.
No. We don't think it's. So if we had followed this curve, it would go up and then eventually it would saturate. Right.
Even above the critical field.
No. Above the critical field, it doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Right, so it will just be a straight line, and then it will just deviate from, it will just saturate. No. The gap value is 14 Kelvin for this field. At 30 Tesla, this fit, to the extent that you can pull out, gets 12 Kelvin. So it's starting to come down. But, you know, I would hesitate to call anything you extract from these lines as gaps, because I know it's headed for saturation. Well, that's for the theory to decide. Am I running out of time?
No.
Oh, okay. You scared me. All right. So what happens when you step away from the Dirac point? So this plot is an attempt to show this, right? This is now logarithmic. So remember I told you that n equals 1 and minus 1 stay put. You know, they don't change with a field or temperature. But this is a 10,000 factor, right? This is headed for 40 megaohms. And so this divergence is strictly confined to the n equals 0 lambda level, which is what I tried to show here. The two dashed lines demarcate the width of the n equals 0 lambda level. So it all happens right at the Dirac point. So this is a cartoon of what the experiments are showing, right, for what we think is the contours of the constant R0. If you are below, so this is field, this is temperature, here's 0 Kelvin. If you are below the critical field, the resistance increases, and then it saturates at low enough temperature. So you can sort of see this by this curve here, right? This cut is that cut. And you can also see it by here, you're below the critical field. As you decrease the temperature, it goes up and then it saturates. Once it hits this, quote, costless-stowless line, right, so it saturates. Otherwise, you know, at 0 Kelvin, all of this should be infinity, which is what we don't see. But if you go above the critical field, which is this last curve here, well, this last curve is not quite there, but if we had more field, this is presumably what it would do. It would be activated all the way, because this would be a true insulator. At T equals 0, there would be absolutely no way to measure any finite conductance. And so this is sort of the contour, the tentative contour that we have in mind today, that there is a critical transition here, and it has both this saturation value as well as this purely activated form depending on where you are. And presumably at finite temperature, the boundary, the phase boundary extends above 16 Kelvin and eventually has to do this, right? But anyway, this we claim is the ordered phase of this puzzling many-body state. And is it excitonic condensation or some other state that we haven't thought of before? Yeah.
If you plotted a similar plot for 1 over sigma xx in a quantum Hall transition, mm-hmm. in gallium arsenide or somewhere, of 1 over sigma xx when you just approach the nu equals 2 plateau, wouldn't you get something also divergence and
Yeah, but here because we're at n equals 0, 1 over sigma is R.
Yeah.
It's identical. But, you're saying if you took a 2D Gallium arsenide sample.
If you did the same thing in Gallium arsenide but plotted 1 over sigma x, which is a quantity you wouldn't usually plot.
Yeah, but you wouldn't get this singular increase in the resistance. Am I right? There's no singularity that you would get from some such...
You'd get an activated divergence if you did.
No, it's activated in temperature, but it would not be singular versus field.
There would not be... you're saying that here there's a field...
Right,
above
right,
which
right,
it is in.
Right,
that's
right.
Above it.
Right. Yeah. So, Adi, let me say it this way, right? You see thermal activation this way, which presumably is not surprising if you have a gap, right? But when you go this way, that is a singular point. This is where the R0 is ticking off in this costless Thouless way. I mean, it's just shooting up.
What's the size of the sample?
10 microns. Usually our samples are 10 microns by 20. Okay. How much time do I have left?
Minus 1 minute. you can go on.
I was going to show... Okay, let me take minus 2 minutes. I'll show the okay, so the thermal power, which is a technology borrowed from Phil Kim. Phil was famous for nanotube thermal power and thermal conductivity before he did all this nice work on graphene. So the thermal power versus magnetic field has these Landau level oscillations. It gives us yet another way to probe these high field states. And the conductance is in green. You probably can't see it very well. But anyway, the thermal power can be measured. What's striking about graphene is that the Nernst effect, this is Johnson and Girvan's theory, which is presumably very well known to many of you here. But what's nice is that you can actually see the Nernst effect, or it is thermal power at three different fields, and they spread out. You can't see you can't analyze them very well until you do the Nernst effect. So at the Dirac point, you see a huge Nernst signal, right? It towers above the other levels right here in the bowl curve, and it's positive, so it has the same sign as the vortex Nernst effect in superconductors, although the origin obviously is quite different. But that's a sign to remember. It imitates the sign of vortex flow. Now, if you know the Nernst signal versus field and the thermal power, they are basically the electric field components when you drive electron flow with a temperature gradient. But the quantity of interest for theorists is actually alpha and alpha xy. Oh, I forgot to tell you. Alpha is the tensor that links temperature gradient to charge current in an infinite sample. Right? Because we don't have an infinite sample, we have to measure Nernst and thermal power. So once you know these two, you can deconvolute them and get what the theorist wants to see, and that's alpha xy. And this is the quantity that Girvan and Johnson computed. And implicit in the calculation is that this alpha xy current is quantized. It has the value, did I write it down? E k sub b, Boltzmann constant, divided by h, Planck's constant. So they have a value of 93 nanoamps, and it's kind of a neat thing. You take a two-dimensional graphene, put any gradient you want, as long as it's small, and you get quantized charge currents moving in the other direction. Right? So that's 93 nanoamps per Kelvin. So what we want to use this for, which we haven't gotten to yet, is to use this as a probe for the high field state. Once you approach the critical field, something has got to be happening with the Nernst signal. And this is the direction that we want to go towards. Right now, there's a problem with the universal conductance fluctuation, as Phil will tell you. You get enormous fluctuations in both channels when you get below about 10 Kelvin for reasons that are not apparent to me. But so this is an ongoing experiment. Thank you.
Yes. So did you try to fit the to plot the activation gap that fits to some magnetic field dependent?
Versus the field, right?
Versus field.
Yeah, we have some limited data, but we it's an ongoing experiment.
Juan, did two things. So they're all ohmic, these IVs?
Yeah, we're very careful with that, right. So once you get into the self-heating regime, of course not. But if you stay below, it's ohmic. So we were trying to search for this costless, Thouless non-linearity. Mm-hmm. But when you get to 40 or 10 megaohms, the IV curves are very hard to measure reliably. So, yeah, was that the drift of the question?
Yeah, that was one. And then the other one, did you tilt the sample at all?
No. That obviously is something else. Yeah, that's interesting. That's why we want to, this is best explored in-house because there's so many things that you need to do, and the magnet lab only gives you, 3 hours? Yeah, because Phil Kim's taking all the time.
No. First, to answer Shankar's question, there is an example from thin layers of superconductors where you start from zero resistance, you crank up the field, and you get to gigaohm. Now, in those specific samples, if you keep cranking up the field, eventually the resistance goes down to measurable quantities.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you try here, or did you stop at the critical?
No, we for the samples that have reached the limit that, like this one, we run out of field. But for the first sample, which had a transition at a 12 or 13 Tesla, when you go above, it just keeps going, right? I think I showed you one where the self-heating was a problem. We have never seen reentrance. We have never seen it come back down. But it does these... So here was an unfortunate experiment, because this would have been a beautiful one, because the transition is at about 12 Tesla. If we had known then, what to do, this would have, I believe, would just be purely insulated. We have never seen reentrance. But that's the vortex system, right? You're talking about indium oxide and, but we haven't seen that.
None of this sample actually shows yet the new equal plus or minus one type of the plateaus, right? New equal plus minus one plateaus. So if the good sample, they're under the high magnetic field.
No, they do, yeah. So this was already apparent in the very first one.
I expect actually one and minus one.
Yeah, so that'll be a shoulder here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you recall you have to go to a 30 Tesla field, right? So here, this is all 14, this is all in-house. I imagine if this had been taken to the magnet lab, it would show the same split.
So I just wonder whether those kind of degeneracies yet lifted, or it's still kind of not lifted under this experimental condition.
I suspect that it'll be lifted. So you're talking about the split of this this level, right? I suspect it'll be, because all I'm talking about is what happens in this valley, in between. I think these are not affected. But yeah, I can tell. I don't have data.
So fine. Just to follow up, when you look at this in the insulating state, and you look at the gap. So like when you're, for example, at, lower temperatures,
right.
Let's say where R0, where the resistance does saturate, but you're, sorry.
No gap.
Initially it starts to go up.
Oh, here, yeah.
Yeah. So initially it starts to go up in an activated fashion, but then it levels off.
Right.
And so there's some gap that you can extract from that. And I guess my question is about what happens to that gap as you go through the transition. It sounds like it more or less doesn't do anything special. It has some value.
But that gap is, in fact, that upward trend evolves into what we call the gap, right? So if you are at fairly, well, not low, but you know, if you're below the critical field, this is that rise you were talking about, right? Because this is log scale.
Right, but as you get closer to the transition, you said yourself that those start to look activated, but
that's
then
right.
peel away.
Right.
So there could be some gap that you can extract from that.
Yeah, that's and 14 Kelvin, right.
Right, and if you go above...
Above, yeah. So we don't have very good data above because this is getting to be very high in field. So it's not very different from this value, I would say.
Yeah, so it doesn't look. It looks like it just evolves smoothly.
It just evolves smoothly. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. This is probably very naive. Could it be that you're just seeing the n equals zero quantum hole in a finite small system, so that you know the divergence is where sigma xx goes to zero. In an activated fashion, so where the sample is large enough to be larger than the localization length. And the regime where you have a saturation is where the system is too small for single localization, so you never get to the actual zero sigma xx limit.
Yeah, but that still sidesteps the question why you would see the singular behavior versus magnetic field. I hear what you're saying, but why you would see this singular field dependence in that scenario?
So this would be the singular point would be the point where the localization length and the size of the sample become the same.
It's thermally activated above that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So there was one argument that I presented against localization, which half the theorists that I talked to like very much, the other half hated. And that's this trend, you know, as you make the sample cleaner and cleaner, this transition occurs at lower and lower fields. Whereas the localization scenario or any such type would have the opposite trend.
So the cleaner it is, the smaller...
The easier to trigger the transition. Right, right. So if you want to ascribe this divergence to localization, you would be in the awkward position saying if you went to very clean samples, it's the best localized one, right? That's it. I thought that argument was, you know, watertight. But some theorists said, bullshit.
So now it's really...
Every theorist should take a stand, either liking or disliking.
Yes.
Sorry, it's time to stop. Any further questions you should ask him? Thank you very much for this interesting talk.